Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're talking with Rich Benjamin, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by University of Maryland Women's Health for every stage of a woman's life, offering compassionate care and comprehensive obstetric and gynecological services from routine exams to specialized pelvic surgery. More information is available at 1-800-492-5538 or go to www.umm.edu/womenscenter. We are here with Rich Benjamin, who wrote the book Searching for Whitopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. He'll be part of the panel tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Enoch Pratt Library in the Wheeler Auditorium, the fifth in a series of conversations on race that is sponsored by OSI Baltimore. I'm here in the studio with my Monday co-host, my dear friend Anthony McCarthy.
And it's always crowded down there. You and I go down there. We have to stand over in a corner.
That's right.
Because people get there early. So we encourage you if you want to go. And Tim
Wise. I'm always
Wise,
up against the wall there.
That's right. Tim Wise is going to be there also tomorrow night.
410-319-8888. Let's go right to the phones, as I promise our listeners, and Alan in Catonsville, you're on the air.
How are you, Mr. Mark?
Well, I'm well. How are you?
Good, sir. I wanted to give you a call. I'm a 52-year-old, I guess, Caucasian male.
Uh-huh.
My father was Hispanic. I work in College Park. I deal with a lot of Hispanics.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a question about humanism as far as what you were talking about when Mr. Richard was saying that he had visited the different places, and how one of the gentlemen that he was talking to said that in the closed company he still used the N-word. I think, you know, myself, I've really only figured something that was comfortable for me when describing a African American or a black person. I tell my kids, I have two smaller kids, I describe an African American as black. When I'm dealing with a black person or an adult, I say brother or sister. So it's just the terminology thing. I think a lot of us are still learning what is the right term, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
As far as, you know, definitely it's not anything out in left field like the N-word, but when we're talking amongst just everyday mixed company, you know, we have to learn what is respectable for that person, for that culture. I always use amigos. My question was, as far as the humanism aspect of it went,
mm-hmm.
when I hear the discussion about racism, I always say, well, you know what? It seems to me humans have inadvertently treated each other, you know, in an oppressing way. Usually the ones that had were trying to get from the ones that didn't have, or get more, or hold on to what they had, as opposed to that being the driving thing for what people do, and then that greed aspect as opposed to just as, you know, an indifference because of race.
Because, in a historical perspective you're talking about.
Exactly,
right.
Exactly. But I think it stems from, you know, something much more primitive than that. You know what I mean?
Well, I think there's a lot of things that underlie that, Rich Benjamin, you really don't touch on. You don't deal with a lot of historical stuff in your book other than talking about what happened in places like Forsyth County and things like that. This is a book about
It's a book about the present and the future, and there isn't a lot of history. Only in spare moments when the history is critical to the context do I take a very brief diversion.
See another caller, as I promised. Now I have some questions here for myself, as well as getting Andrea and Elizabeth. But first, go to 410-319-8888. Jay, you're on the air. Hi,
Thanks
Jay, you there?
Thanks for taking my call.
Welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I just, you know, the conversation is so interesting, and you know, I don't know where to begin, but I will respond to several of the callers. I'm an African American woman living in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm from the South. I grew up in the South. I moved here. Well, I think Baltimore is the South, but nobody, you can't tell people that.
I grew up here.
That's
and it was
true.
The South when I was growing up. I'll tell you that. Go ahead.
I grew up in Pensacola, Florida, which is close to Alabama and Mississippi. And, you know, class and race is very defined where I'm from. And here, people like to think that, you know, we are so much more beyond that, but what I've learned is that it's not much different. And I do believe that black people can be racist. You know, I know that as a people, we don't have the power to cause systemic oppression. But I think in the way we treat each other and the way we respect each other and our differences, absolutely. you know, we can have a racist bent in trying to raise children in this city and having the effect of children as I do in my job. I think it's, you know, it's critical that we try to be more accepting and teach people just to be better humans. And I don't know what we're going to do as a race of people or as a society, how, what the, you know, the avenue to progress is, but it is, you know, alive and well. And the fact that there are these communities that have separated themselves really doesn't shock me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it saddens me because I'd just like to think that we have progressed much better than that. But, you know, I can't wait to get the book. I wish I could be with you tomorrow, but I'm in class. But I can't wait to get this book and to open dialogue with the friends and the people that I'm closest to.
Good. I mean, it's be a good book for, I think, groups to read together and to talk about. It'd be a great book club book.
Oh, most definitely.
For people to kind of really wrestle with what Rich Benjamin has said. Rich, what would you say to what you just heard from Jay?
She put it so well, there's nothing more to say.
Well, let me, it's taking off of what Jay said, let me ask you a question while we go back to the phones. And you, when you write about Forsyth County, you mm-hmm. have a very chilling, when you do write about history, it's a very chilling moment when you write about Dr. Ansel Strickland
mm-hmm.
and his home. And the lynching of two black boys and how two-thirds of the town showed up, 8,000 people on his lawn, and it's now a historic site, I think you wrote about, and you went to that house by accident. I mean, and that this is the all-white county with, that expelled black folks in 1912 that surrounds Atlanta. Talk about, A, your experiences for our listeners in Forsyth, and then, well, just start there.
Well, it's a chilling history. Forsyth County is about an hour north of Atlanta. It's an exurb. And first, Forsyth County is part of the territory that expelled the Native Americans during the 1837 Trail of Tears. So you have that first wave of expulsion. And then in 1912, a young white girl was raped. Black youth were accused. One was lynched. One was taken to trial. And after the trial, at the barrel of a gun, the black residents of the county were expelled. And this is documented in history. It's a well-known fact. And so the property where the young black kid was lynched now is where the Forsyth County Chamber of Commerce sits. So there I go to interview the Chamber of Commerce simply about growth and taxes and business issues. And it's the very house or the very property where the boy was lynched and where black folks were expelled from the county. This history is very much alive and well. And another eerie part of that county's history is the slave graves. I mean, there's a lot of unmarked, unnamed, unremembered, unaccounted for slaves who are buried with unmarked graves. And their descendants took me to visit the graves. And you could verify that, in fact, it's the graves. You can verify it by tax records, county deeds, and so forth, you know, what historians use, archives. And now these unmarked graves are sprinkled along subdivisions and million-dollar homes and gated communities, and you literally have to schlep and tromp through white people's property to visit these unmarked slave graves, and I did so with the descendants of the family. And so it's a weird mix. When we talk about class, I mean, it's a weird mix of what people have done with property, who earned the property, who did not earn the property, how it is used today. And the people, the white people who are living on this property, they're unaware of it. It's not like they stole the property. I mean, here we are in the 2000s. So, you know, they just bought a nice home only to find out it sits on someone's burial plot. So it is. It's a very tangled history. It's a very ugly history in many cases. And I discovered that history. So on the one hand, you know, I'm golfing, I'm playing poker, I'm going to the mega church, I'm having a good old time, and it's juxtaposed against this history that I believe Forsyth hasn't successfully dealt with.
So how do you deal with that? I mean, how do you compare what happened to you and the experiences you have? Because you also have a very interesting piece about the Upper East Side of New York, which I found fascinating in terms of class and race and denial. How do you think about and analyze and compare what happened to you and you experienced this in Forsyth, you experienced this in Idaho, where you spent huge amounts of time, and you experienced this back home on the Upper East Side of New York City, and race and white people's attitudes towards you and your attitudes towards them. Can you kind of talk a bit about the complexity of that for you?
Yeah, it is hard, because on the one hand, I happen to be a history buff. I study history. I take pains to learn history as it happened. On the other hand, I'm living in the here and the now and the today, just like you are. I have to make a decision where to eat, mm-hmm. where to hang out, and all this. And so sometimes it's very difficult to reconcile. Sometimes you're literally driving, you know, to run your errands, and you're running by this history that's, like, embedded in the community. So that's how you reconcile it sometimes. And depending on where I am in these Y-topias, it has a different effect. I feel Georgia's different than Idaho, is different than my native New York City.
And sometimes there's a subtlety of difference. The people don't even see themselves in many ways.
Yes. I mean, so in Forsyth County, you use the word denial, and I think that's a great word. There's this form of white innocence that we say, oh, let bygones be bygones.
Right.
And they don't want to address that, and so that's that. But in here in New York City, there's a huge denial, too. I mean, in New York City, I study a community that's as white as Idaho because of segregation patterns, because of decisions the community has taken. And this community went for Obama.
Right. We're talking about the Upper East Side of New York.
Yeah. The Upper Seat of Manhattan, by census tract, went for Obama, yet it is as white as Idaho.
Go back to the phones. I should tell me anything. 410-319-8888. Elizabeth in Cockeysville, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I'm moved and impressed by the profound underlying themes that everyone is raising and you are raising for us. I think a part of this for me, and I'm in my 70s, I'm a white middle-class person who's been in education and had a privilege of working with many different races and cultures throughout my lifetime. And I think some issues come out for me. I think the importance of naming and knowing our history. And there's an arrogance of ignorance when we don't have our hearts and minds open to naming and knowing the history, as has been pointed out just now. There are trails of tears. I've worked with indigenous persons, and out in Utah, of course, there are indigenous people, which haven't been mentioned in our conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, I think it's been raised as a theme, the language we use in our communications and when we use this language and with whom in a way that can open minds and hearts and not close them. And that's really, those are very, very challenging things for us. And I think for many persons, the whole notion of accusation of racism closes minds and hearts. And yet there is a what I call a poisonous and viral ethnocentrism that is embedded in all human beings, whether it be the Hopi and the Navajo or the people in New York or those in Forsyth, Georgia, or wherever. And each of us is subject to that viral ethnocentrism, and we can move beyond it. And in our discussions, trying to learn how to name and communicate in ways that bring us back to our common humanity and lead us forward to a better moment in history, they're profound. And so I thank you for having all these things bubble up in your conversation.
Thank you so much for those comments. And what are your thoughts about that, and especially where you think we are going with all of this? And, I mean, when you went, a lot of those counties in Whitetopia, those places in Whitetopia that you went to, Rich Benjamin, you also talked about the stats and the voting, and that the numbers against Obama were in larger numbers in the white population in those areas than they were in the rest of the country. So, and you also had these relationships that were very interesting and profound, and they were also very real. I mean, anybody who's worked construction or just lived in mostly white rural areas or who's fought in a war knows that people overcome race in certain conditions. So I'm just curious where you think all this leads us now.
We'll see. First,
Yes, we will.
No. I'm just kidding. Or a mystic. No, we'll see. But I'll tell you where it leads us immediately. What about immigration reform? These issues are going to come to a head. We're going to have to deal with immigration. The Obama administration says that we're going to have to deal with immigration reform come 2010. So that'll be fascinating what goes on. Because when I visited these communities, I did not expect how hot an issue immigration, specifically Latinos, are.
Mm-hmm.
And when Joe Wilson stood up in Congress and cried out to the president, "You lie," because he's worried his tax dollars are going to go, quote-unquote, wasted on illegal immigrants, I had been hearing this for 2 years traveling Whiteopia. So you're asking me, where is this going to lead us? Most immediately, it's going to lead us how we deal with immigration. How do we, you know, we have these tea protest movements. We have these anti-immigration movements. We have these movements that say the president is not an American. One of the most poignant posters I've seen has a picture of Obama, and it has the caption, "Undocumented worker." And so in that context, this identity crisis in pockets of conservative white America, we'll see where it's going to lead us when we try and reform immigration. But I don't know if you're asking more into the future where it's going to lead us.
No,
but
I'm just curious your perceptions. I mean, because we're at a kind of a critical time, I think, politically, where the divide is as much driven by the ideology as by race, but it's all intertwined. We can't separate the two that deeply, I think.
I agree. I mean, there's ideology and there's a divide in this country. Even if we didn't have a black president, even if our president was Hillary Clinton, they'd be attacking her, and vice versa. The Democrats would be attacking Republicans. So that's ideological. There is a racial component when we begin to talk about health care and when we begin to talk about immigration. And I don't bring this in. Go to the protests and they will literally say, "We oppose public spending and we oppose this health care because we don't want to bankroll needy illegal immigrants." So it's all bubbling up, and I agree with you. This is, you're putting your finger on one of the critical backstories of this book. We're fighting two global wars. We're dealing with political partisanship. We're dealing with a changing nation. We're dealing with a melting down economy. All these institutions that we took for granted, the government, the nuclear family, the idea of work, the idea of a fair economy, they're melting, and people are scared. And here I could use an expletive,
don't,
and I won't. But it's a moment, and part of what I'm trying to spark is, are we going to put our best foot forward and deal with these fears and deal with this moment and change it into an opportunity? Are we going to, you know, summon our lesser angels?
Well, Richard, I'm very curious because I recently have heard, I have a friend in New York, Keith Boykin, who wrote a column several years ago and got in so much trouble. He said that he was known as a gay and lesbian activist, but mm-hmm. that he had become post-gay. And that he wanted to move past that identity, past those politics. I have heard so many people call into my show and to Mark's show and talk about post-racism or being post-race in America. Because we've elected Obama, because we see record numbers of African Americans being elected, because corporate CEOs are visible and they're black, that we have in this country become post-race. And it is so off base, but I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
It's fascinating. And to be perfectly honest with you, part of me identifies with the people who want to be post this. I want to be post-identity because it's easier, it's better in some ways. So I have that in me. But let me just put it this way. Ask the immigrant who was just killed in suburban New York because he's an immigrant and they're shouting ethnic slurs at him whether we are post-anything. And so, as much as I would like to be post-identity, the facts just don't bear out. Part of the reason Latino communities hang together, it's not because they have ethnocentrism or because they have jingoism. It's because they feel intimidated living in places where they can afford to live because they don't speak English the way we speak English. So I don't think we're there yet.
Let's go back to the phones of 410-319-8888 as we talk to Rich Benjamin, who wrote the book Searching for Whitetopia. William, you're on the air.
Yes, good evening, Mr. Steinman.
Good evening.
And your guests. I just have a question in reference to the identity of the so-called black man and white man. If people are named geographically, where is that land? Where is the land that you get the name black man or white man?
Well, that's a good question. Rich, do you want to tackle that? I mean...
Yeah, no. People aren't named geographically. People right. are named after race, ethnicity, so...
And culture.
Yeah, and no, they're not. It's a couple, because we created... I mean, it was really... Ethnic hatred is as old as humankind, but the racism we experience now
that's
is a
right.
very modern thing, and that's where it comes from, I think. 410-319-8888. Andrea, you're on the air.
All right, taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Before I just called in, kind of touched on what I wanted to talk about, but I think one of the reasons why it's taking so long for us to, I guess, to be post-race or whatever is the way we define race and discuss it as if it were some kind of biological reality. When race is discussed, we rarely, talk about the social concepts. And as you were saying, it's really, it's a modern thing. And the fact that we still feel it's okay to classify people by the color of the skin, it's okay for, you know, white and black, but if we were to refer somebody that's of American Indian descent or someone that has Asian lineage, if we were to call them yellow or call, you know, a Native American person red, you know, everybody's jaw would drop. But we think it's okay to still, you know, classify people as, you know, white and black, and the fact that we haven't move towards having better definitions to define different groups of people. I mean, we've tried it, you know, within that, and I'll say black for lack of a better word, community, you know, with the whole African-American thing, but, you know, people that are in the United States as a part of the African diaspora and, you know, being shipped over here from slavery, those African ties were cut long ago, so why do we have to be defined with a continent that we were essentially ripped from and have no ties with anymore? So, I mean, it's just really interesting how we haven't worked to find better terminology to address the differences within groups of people and cultures. And
Andrea, you have raised a very powerful and complex and interesting question, a quandary. That I think we need to wrestle with, and we are loath to do it because I don't think Rich Benjamin, even can figure out how to do it yet.
Yeah, and people are struggling as we speak. How do you do that with the census? How are we going to count the American population and define folks? Are we going to define them by race in the Latino case, or is it a geographic definition? So, yeah, no, point's very valid.
I mean, you know, if you, in Panama and other countries, a lot of folks don't say, no, I'm not black. I'm not a Negro. I'm Panamanian. Though in those countries also, in Cuba and other places, there's a consciousness about being a descended from Africa growing at the same time. And this is, and I mean, the whole nature of slavery and what it put upon all of us is making it very hard for, we're just beginning now to wrestle with how do we deal with our history, live in the present, and redefine it all. I mean, we have not come to that place. And I think what you're saying in your book, Rich, is we are at a place where we could be doing that. We're not. We could be getting there.
Exactly. And it's to our advantage to get there. So it's not an academic exercise.
Mark, it's interesting. When Thanksgiving, I called one of my aunts. My grandfather is white. And that's where we get the name McCarthy. And I think a lot of people
Your grandfather.
My grandfather. Mm-hmm. My father's father is mm-hmm. Caucasian. And she doesn't identify herself as black. And oftentimes when we talk about my aunt that
Your
I called
aunt
over
does.
Thanksgiving,
uh-huh.
who's my father's sister, she corrected me when I talked about our family. And when I mentioned black, she says, wait a minute, Anthony, we're not black. Because she pointed out that my grandfather in my generation, two generations from, was white, and his family was white, and they're very much still a part of our family. And the president we classify as black, but the president's mother is not black, his family. But we are so uncomfortable pushing this mm-hmm. dialogue, pushing this conversation, but I think books like Searching for Whitetopia have moved us into a place where there is the potential to speak truth. And even truth that makes us uncomfortable. But when we get through that discomfort, we're better people. We really are better people, regardless of who we are.
That's true. It's all, it makes me think of my former wife's family.
That's right.
and it was a wonderful woman, and her family was just this Native American black, and on her mother's side, octoroon slaves and slave masters having kids who passed for white and kids who remained in the African, in the black community. I mean, it's always been like a difficult issue and for us to wrestle with. And I enjoy the wrestling match. We have
Me
to
too.
Have it.
Me
we
too.
Have to have the wrestling match. 410-319-8888. Let's try to get another caller or two in here if we can. Mackenzie, you're on the air.
Hi. Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment on my experiences in Maryland as far as race. I just found that I grew up in Anne Arundel County, and now I'm living in Baltimore, and I work actually in Baltimore County in the White Marsh area.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that just in this White Marsh area, Baltimore County area, a lot of people do not, I've encountered a lot of racism. I'm African American, and growing up in Anne Arundel County, I was in D.C. a lot, in Columbia. And there I find a lot of people are much more progressive. And there's a lot of intermingling where blacks hang with whites in like clubs and restaurants and so forth, especially in D.C. And I find that I think the real problem is the separation. Here in White Marsh and especially in Bel Air, where it's predominantly white, they don't really hang around a lot of African Americans.
Right.
And even so, and the ones that they do hang around, just in my experiences, I found the class, they're uneducated, and they think all blacks are, you know, just uneducated and have very poor, they don't think very highly of blacks in that area. But in D.C., where you have a much more higher class of blacks or affluent blacks, people are intermingling and they have a better description of blacks.
Mackenzie, we have to go to break here, though I would say that if you go to Patterson Park, you see poor white, working class, black, white, Latino, Asian kids all in this mix in one of the few integrated high schools we have in the city, which is in a working class neighborhood. But we are just touching the edges here, and I want to encourage everybody to continue this dialogue tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at the Enoch Pratt Library, Open Society Institute's fifth conversation on race. Our guest, this part, Rich Benjamin, will be part of that. Rich Benjamin, of course, who's written the book we've been talking about, Searching for Whitetopia, and a Probable Journey to the Heart of White America. We'll be joined by Tim Wise, who wrote the book Between Barack and a Hard Place, Racism and White Denial in the Age of Obama. And at 7 o'clock tomorrow night, Enoch Pratt Free Library at the Wheeler Auditorium. That's 400 Cathedral Street in downtown Baltimore. And Anthony and I, well, at least, I don't know if you're going, but I'm going to get down there tomorrow night after the show. And Rich Benjamin, thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Thank you. I was glad to be here.
I really enjoyed it. Look forward to meeting you tomorrow night.
Thank you. Me too.
All right. Take care.
Okay.
We'll be right back, and we're going to switch gears and take a look at the trial that will not go away. Or will not end, I should say. We're going to be talking about Sheila Dixon Strong. We come back with Melody Simmons, our reporter, of course, is becoming every day. Dwight Pettit joins us by phone, criminal defense attorney based here in Baltimore. Number is 410-319-8888. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And we will continue this conversation. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Stop by one of its seven branches or go to mecu.com. For more information, I am joined by my Monday co-host, Anthony McCarthy, whose show airs here every Friday in this time slot from 5 to 7 p.m. That would be the Anthony McCarthy Show. And he's here co-hosting with me now. Anthony? Here we go.
Here we go, Mark.
We are joined on the phone by Melody Simmons, who is a journalist and reporter for the Mark Steiner Show and WEAA at times and the Center for Emerging Media, which produces both Anthony's show and my show. And on the phone also is Dwight Pettit, criminal defense attorney, well-known defense attorney here in Baltimore. And Dwight Pettit and Melody Simmons, welcome. Good to have both of you with us.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Mark. Anthony.
Hey, Dwight. Hey, Melody.
Thank you both so much. It's always a pleasure to hear both your voices on our show. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in on this conversation, to have your thoughts on this trial and where we're going. So, Melody, I know you only have like 10 minutes or so, so let me begin with you and tell us what you saw today and your analysis of what you saw today.
Well, today was very interesting. It was, of course, the sixth day of deliberation in the trial, and it's been now more time deliberating than actual evidence and witness testimony. So the scales have tipped a little bit that way, and so there's a lot of waiting going on in the courtroom, and about 3:15 today, a note came out, and the jury asked, or they just informed Judge Sweeney, quote, "We cannot come to a unanimous decision on all counts."
Hmm.
And it was signed by the four women. And so the judge called everybody together and started talking to both teams, wondering, how to respond to that. And in the meantime, a second note along this line came out of the jury room. And basically it said, "Judge Sweeney, we feel we need to return tomorrow to resume deliberations because new things have been brought to light." So it was a little cryptic. It was a little bit of whiplash. Basically, the judge asked both sides what they thought, and they both the prosecution thought that they should be allowed to have as much time as they need to deliberate. The defense moved for a mistrial. So the judge
again.
Denied the motion. Yes, again. And the judge denied the motion for the mistrial, and the jury will be back to deliberate again beginning at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Now, Anthony, I wish you'd posed the question that you posed to me about your questions about this mixed verdict.
Oh, yeah.
You had for
I'm very curious. I'm so glad we have Dwight Pettit with us because I'm sure he can dissect this for us. I'm putting a lot on your shoulders, Dwight. Very curious about the note that came from the jury about not being able to reach consensus on all counts. Is it possible, Dwight, that this could be a split verdict, found guilty on some counts, acquitted on some counts?
That seems to be what the judge was going to ask the jury, Anthony, as I understand the reporting before the second note came in.
Correct.
Had they reached any unanimous conclusions on any of the charges.
So, Dwight,
so that's a possibility.
As you've been analyzing the notes that came out early last week before they went on Thanksgiving break and today, it's pure speculation on everybody's part. But where do you think this jury is wrestling? Where is the difficulty in coming to consensus, or can they come to consensus?
Well, this jury has totally surprised me. I thought they were going to sort of reach an early verdict.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, even on Mark's show and our conversations, I thought that reasonable doubt had been created by some of the movements by the prosecution in terms of not putting on the Lipscomb testimony and then asking certain things, the judge asking that certain things be not considered, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
So from that perspective, I thought that there would be reasonable doubt possibly generated. As the jury has moved on, I began to think it was a hung jury. And then when the messages begin to come out and at the same time not reflecting any type of hung situation, I felt as though they were going to get a verdict. And so when they came back today, and I mean, both the notes are so inconsistent. One note says we're not reaching a unanimous verdict, and then the second one says we have some something else has come to light. What else could come to light?
that
they don't have in front of?
That was going to be my question. When they said how could anything come to light that hasn't already been brought to light in this jury, Melody? Unless some light bulb went off in somebody's head.
Well, it's a bit stunning. I have to tell you, nobody understands it. It's kind of like trying to read the tea leaves. And, when a statement like that comes out of the jury room after the prior note, it's kind of seismic. And then the judge called the jurors back into the courtroom, and they looked very stressed. There were a lot of body language, arms folded in front of their chest. One woman appeared to be wiping her eyes as though she had been just emotionally overcome by I the deliberation. So I think what we're having in that room is just loggerheads.
I think, you know, people have taken sides, and the interesting aspect about it would be what those numbers are, as you indicated, Anthony. And I think maybe the jury, you know, through a few minutes of discussion, felt as if they rested and reconvened tomorrow morning. There might be a possibility of some type of unanimous decision. But I tend to think now it's moving more toward a hung jury.
Let me open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on where this trial is going and what a hung jury would mean for this city, what it would mean politically. And unfortunately, one of the things that Melody and I talked about the other day, and in the last hour we talked about race in America and the difficulties of race in America, what it might mean racially. Maybe it will, maybe it won't, but that certainly is a possibility that that divide exists as well. Melody, you have to run. Is that what I understand?
I do. I have a commitment tonight. I'm sorry, guys. I can't stay on.
That's always
fine.
Great to
be
talk
that
to
way,
you.
Melody. I'm just kidding. Have a wonderful evening, and thank you so much for all the work you're doing for us.
Thank you. Talk to you tomorrow.
Talk to you tomorrow.
Take care, Melody.
Yourself.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. 410-319-8888. And Melody is like our right arm. She's Melody
really
Simmons
is
just stood by me and by us through thick and thin here and has been covering stuff, an amazing journalist, and we're happy to have her on our team and lucky to have her. 410-319-8888. Anthony McCarthy is here. We're talking about the trial. Dwight Pettit on the phone, noted criminal defense attorney here in Baltimore. 410-319-8888. Bob in, don't know where you're from, but you're on the air.
Baltimore.
Okay, there you go.
Name for this case. Gift card gate. That's what it is. It reminds me of that 74 trial. It went on and on and on. So I got a feeling it's going to be a hung jury. She can move on.
Well,
thank you guys.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Bob.
I'm not sure about the moving on, though, because there is a trial scheduled for March.
Mm-hmm.
And a hung jury, in my mind, and I appreciate Bob's opinion, obviously, and I'd be curious about what Dwight thinks, who has his finger on the pulse of politics in this city and this state, as well as, obviously, the legal community. It raises a lot of questions, leaves a lot of questions out there, a hung jury. Not a conviction, not an acquittal. As she goes into, another trial in March, and then an election the following year. I think it does leave a lot of questions that Sheila Dixon will have to find some way to navigate, speak to, depending on the outcome of this trial. What do you think, Dwight?
Well, I think if the jury is hung, I don't see how the prosecution
moves forward.
Is able to have the political mandate to proceed with a second trial. I think the prosecution is in a very difficult situation, and I think the hung jury, not as good as an acquittal, but under these circumstances, might almost be as good as an acquittal.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are two questions here. Before we go back to phones at 410-319-8888. One is, it seems to me that Rohrbaugh, the state prosecutor, I mean, if he sees what the divide is on the jury, let's say it's a close vote, and it's hung. Why wouldn't he say, okay, we're going to do this again, but we're going to ask for a change of venue?
Well, I think we're talking about two things before you go, Mark. One is the repeat of this trial versus the continuation of the second trial.
Okay.
If the numbers indicate that this jury was close to conviction rather than in the reverse, then he might be moved to, in fact, proceed for a second trial or be more aggressive as to a second trial on these charges. As to the second case, that could have bearing on whether he proceeds or not, but I think a hung jury with the time period between now and the second trial is going to weigh politically heavy on him, but at the same time, he's between a rock and a hard place because it's going to be very difficult for him to back away.
And there is rumors, and I'm not sure if this has ever been confirmed, Mark, that Rohrbaugh is actually retiring.
I think in January from the state prosecutor's office.
I've heard a lot of people say that.
What'd you say? Change of venue is not his discretion. back to what you were saying.
Oh, okay.
But couldn't he request to the judges that they change the venue for the next trial?
No, that would have to be on the motion of defense. And they wouldn't dare leave Baltimore City.
It would not be the prosecutor.
I see.
Okay. I'm glad I understand that, because I thought that the prosecutor could say, you need to change the venue to have a more objective jury.
No, they would go venue shopping, and the argument against that is that venue can cure any problems in terms of pretrial publicity.
Okay.
In other words, you can voir dire the jury just as they did this time. And just because it was the mayor, you're going to have just as many people who've heard about it this time as they did the first time. And the magic question comes, can you set that aside and make a fair decision from the evidence that's put before you? And when they say that cures it.
Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888 here with my co-host Anthony McCarthy. It's Monday. And Dwight Pettit joins us by phone. He's noted criminal defense attorney here in Baltimore, in Maryland, in the country. 410-319-8888. Michael, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Mark?
Welcome.
I just want to ask a question real quick. Now, I've been following this trial with the Sheila Dixon and everything, that I see that they saying the defense is getting upper hand on in her defense, and then next thing you know, it's going to the, prosecutors, and all of a sudden, do you think they're trying to put it in the hung jury so they know she's coming up in a trial in March? That's what I want to know, because it seems like because her status is the mayor, that they might not, judge, what I'm trying to say, judge.
This is a prosecutorial strategy? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying is because we should think this trial should have been over by now, and it looks like they're trying to send it out and trying to get a hang jury and stuff like that because they know she goes back to court in next year in March, and that's what I want to ask the question. That's
okay.
What I'm trying to do.
That's an interesting question, Dwight. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't think the March trial date affects the deliberations on this jury. I think this jury is actually struggling to, in fact, come up with a unanimous verdict one way or the other. I think that you're going to find that there's a breakdown when the smoke clears and it's all over. There's going to be a racial breakdown or a political breakdown in terms of the numbers of this jury.
But Dwight, what about, and I know I hate to even ask this question, but he really raised it in my mind, and I heard some folks talk about it over the weekend, so I'd be surprised if the jurors didn't hear anybody talking about it over the weekend. But there is this train of thought here in the city that this prosecution team really is using this as a setup for the March trial, that the information that was used about Lipscomb and then pulled, the evidence that the jury was told disregard this information, but the information essentially was already out there, that this really is just a setting up a stronger foundation to make even the March trial a little bit stronger against the mayor.
Well, that goes back, Anthony. If you want to give the prosecution the credit for being that strategic.
That's a good point.
Far ahead and take the kind of risk that they took by not putting Mr. Lipscomb on. I just don't give them that much credit.
I agree. Okay.
I mean, that's what people can say. Oh, it's a brilliant strategy. I don't think so.
I think I would go with Dwight's analysis on that one. 410-319-8888. Lindsay, you're on the air.
I just wanted to talk about the jury and the notes, the conflicting notes that they're putting out there, and, why the judge is so, I understand they're doing their civic duty and all of that, but the jury seems a little overwhelmed with this trial and why the judge won't declare a mistrial, because there's so much conflicting, notes coming from the jury. And then somebody said that one of the jurors looked frustrated or overwhelmed or emotional. It seems as if they would declare a mistrial, the judge would grant a mistrial and not put, the jurors and the taxpayers through this any longer, because it's really dragging on.
Dwight, what do you think
about
that?
I've always argued, and again on Mark's show, I've argued that a mistrial was in order. I thought a mistrial was in order from the time the prosecution changed the strategy and not putting on Mr. Lipscomb and then telling them to disregard certain evidence and forget what they've heard. At that point in time, my argument was that the jury would be confused and that either a mistrial should have been declared or it should have been reserved on and held until the end. By them bringing it back, it's the same consequences as if the judge had reserved. Anyway, but I think to go to the heart of the caller's question, you got to remember, as I recall it, all of those notes basically implied that they could reach a verdict until today. Today is the first time that they said to the court that we cannot reach a verdict, and then they sort of reversed that. So Judge Sweeney was sort of tied in. Once he denied the mistrial, he was sort of tied in and not granting the mistrial until the jury made the indication that they were hung or they could not reach a unanimous verdict. So that just happened today. So up to now, even though it had been some lengthy time, he more or less had to accept the wishes of the jury that they wanted to continue to deliberate because the verdict, the unanimous verdict, was in sight and possible.
Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. A lot of questions from our listeners here. Lindsay, thanks so much for that call and a really intriguing question. Dennis, you're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Hi, Dennis.
What happened, Dennis? I think we hit a wrong button and we lost Dennis. Dennis, call right back and we'll pop you back on the air here. 410-319-8888. And let's go to Cynthia. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Well, we're well. Welcome. I'm trying to get my mouth running. There you go.
I just want to throw this out because I don't know what the jury is thinking and I don't know where this is going to go. But one thing that has run through my mind as a woman is, are they trying to throw the women under the bus while these guys get deals? And that's just something for you to think about. And maybe you don't want to talk about it now, but is that a possibility?
Well, what guys are you talking about?
I'm talking about the guys who all plead, you know, were willing to testify against her and say they gave this and that. And yet they, you know, they don't face any kind of charges.
Well, actually, they both had to pay serious fines, if I'm right.
They paid fines. That's different from going to trial and possibility of, you know, going to jail. You don't think so?
Well, Dwight?
I'm not sure that I understand the question, but in trying to respond, one person who did testify did, in fact, have charges brought against him.
Linwood Carpenter.
Yeah, and he was convicted. Lipscomb, as you indicated, was given probation in agreement for cooperating with the state. And Turner, there was determined that there was no criminal culpability. I think the question was in terms of some type of disparate treatment in terms of the male witnesses versus the females on the jury. Am I hearing that right?
No, I think that some of...
I think she was saying that she wondered if there were, I think you're right about the disparate treatment, but I think that she was concerned about the male witnesses against the female mayor and that maybe there was some discrimination going on, treating the men differently than this female defendant.
Well, I think if that is part of the question, I think the protective device there is the fact that nine of the jurors are female.
Are female. That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. And I give the defense all the credit in the world for their voir dire and their jury selection. I think they got a very representative jury without, in fact, crossing the lines in terms of racial selection or sexual selection, meaning striking jurors because of mm-hmm. race, sex, or some other reason, or constitutional reason.
And the caller before the last caller, Dennis, I think you inadvertently hung up upon. Please call back at 410-319-8888. We'll get your thoughts in the air. Look like you had kind of an enthusiastic, good question. I want to hear what you had to say. Didn't cut you off on purpose. Sharon in Edgewood, you're on the air. Sharon, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Sharon. I want to thank
Sharon.
You for accepting. Yes, thank you for accepting my call.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I certainly hope that this trial does not end in a mistrial, in a hung jury. I do suspect that it will, however, but I think it's reasonable for the juries to send this conflicting statements because you have to realize you have 12 people trying to come to a consensus and they all have their own opinions and they see things from a different perspective and a different point of view. So I think some of the callers that are calling in are being a little bit too hard on the jury. I mean, as a former juror, it's something that you take very seriously. You want to be sure that you interpret all the information accurately, and you want to make the right decision. So I think that some people are going to have a certain opinion, and others are going to have a different opinion, and you kind of strive to get your point across so that you all can reach the consensus that you most agree with. You understand what I'm saying?
No, absolutely do.
Sharon, I think... Sharon, is that how you pronounce it?
Sharon.
Sharon, yes.
I think more so than that is that the jury has had the time to understand the historical political implications involved here. And if they didn't understand it before they went home, they darn sure had an opportunity to understand it by eating turkey with family and friends.
I think you're right, Dwight.
Right.
And they're carrying a tremendous weight on their shoulders.
it's one of the hardest jobs in the world is being on a jury, I think. It's a very tough thing to do.
Dwight, what about this idea, and I've read it in The Sun and other places on some of the social networks, where people are saying this judge is not being as strong and direct with this jury as he should be.
I think
that the jury seems to be in control of this situation.
Well, you know, at a certain point in time, it's the judge's show.
Mm-hmm.
And after it goes into the deliberation process, it's the jury. It's their ball game. It's their bailiwick. And if he does anything under the law to, in fact, imply any type of coercion or force on the jury, then that can invalidate and taint the proceedings. So he has to be very careful in his dealing with the jury once that jury goes into deliberations. They are the judge of law. I mean, not law. He's the judge of law, but they are the judge of fact in the state under the Maryland law and the state law. And once they get it, for example, it keeps coming up about whether he will instruct them on an Allen charge.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, the courts have said, you know, you've got to be very, very careful when you get into that area. It may be a discretionary thing by the court, but if it's coercive, you can't do it unless all sides would agree. So he's got a very fine line to walk in terms of not coercing that jury, but trying to tell them to stick to their convictions, yet at least listen to their neighbors. And he's got to do that in such a way that they're not intimidated or coerced. So I think so far he's handling the jury quite well on the fact that he hasn't declared the motion or hasn't granted the motion for the mistrial.
Interesting point.
I go back to point one, that's probably what he should have done. once the case got confused.
To be clear about that, there's no money orders there. 410-319-8888. Dennis, you're back. You're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Hey, we're well, thank you. Welcome.
My question is about the note and your thoughts pertaining to the question here. They sent the note basically saying that some new evidence had come to light.
No, they didn't say new evidence. They said it. I think the way they phrased it, and Melanie had it exactly, was that it was being looked at in a new light.
A new light, exactly right, right, right.
Okay, so my thought was when I heard that, is the jurors had the whole holiday weekend to go home and to listen to everything and to do their own research, even on the internet, for some of those questions that they couldn't get answered during the week prior. So maybe that's some of the information that had come up once they got together.
I'm not sure if they would admit that. I know that sounds terrible.
I'm not saying they would admit it. I'm not saying that. But maybe that was...
But if they're saying to the judge, we see something in a new light, that means they would have to admit the new light came from their outside conversations, which would nullify the jury.
So you're saying the jury can't say that, can't do that?
No.
Oh.
No.
I tend to think that this long four-day weekend has really, really brought some different issues to the jury deliberation process and allowed it to be tainted. Mm. You got to remember, we can go all the way back to the fact that this jury is not sequestered.
Yeah,
right.
And that's become a major issue. It has become a major issue when you have a deliberation this long, as well as a deliberation going over holidays. Whether or not this jury should have been sequestered, even though that's an expense to the state, and you know, I can't say that the state actually made, I mean, the defense made that request, or the state made the request, or the judge in his discretion would have ruled on it with all the pros and cons to a sequestered jury. But it's coming back to haunt us.
And I think that a lot may haunt us about this when it's over. I mean, if
regardless of the outcome,
right,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tomorrow or Wednesday, if the jury comes back, we'll do at least an hour on what the consequences of the verdict are for Baltimore and for the mayor. And I think that a hung jury, I really think a hung jury means the mayor cannot go on. I mean, because I think that she can go on as mayor, but I mean, can't go on because it's going to muddy the water so deeply. There'll be a lot of political consequences, and it's going to be really hard for the city to move on because in the people's minds, she won't be found innocent.
But you got to remember, this mayor has stared adversity in the face. And as her lawyer said today, Mr. Wayne, she's proven to be a very tough person to handle her business and continue to move with a stiff upper lip through these trials and tribulations of a trial, which can be the most dramatic thing in your life next to illness.
I think there's no question of her toughness
and
in all this.
If she's showing this type of steeliness, then she, if the jury is hung, I think she will continue to govern and disregard the fact that it was a hung jury.
Dwight Pettit, we are out of time. Thank you so much for taking time
with
us again. It's always a pleasure to have you on the air.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you so much. Anthony McCarthy, thanks for being here.
Always great, Mark. Thanks.
5 to 7 p.m. Friday, Anthony McCarthy. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producer is Justin Levy. We're engineered today by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, and Gay Pinder, and they were just on the phones. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.